This represents the final interview with Jesse Haver Butler, and took place almost 10 months after interview 8, the closing interview. This was recorded on March 26, 1974. This tape of closing remarks was recorded at the request of Jesse Haver Butler. There were some areas that she thought might not have been included in the previous sessions, which she wished to have recorded. These included an outline of her goals in life and some specific stories and experiences. She had 3 pages of notes, and in reviewing some of these, however, we found that the material had been covered in previous interviews. She had a very definite plan for the interviews and basically simply spoke. During the latter part of the interview, after we moved to a drawing room in one of the other buildings, her granddaughter joined us. In addition to a discussion of her goals, the material covers her theory of household help and what she learned in England, childcare in the Soviet Union, Hugh Butler's activities in England, including the writing of a book, the school system in Needham, Massachusetts, her relationship to Leslie Cutler, and finally some stories about the Shenandoah Mountains and their ultimate retirement.
This is the end of my story, and to complete it, I would like to give a quick summary of some of the goals that happened, as they do with everyone, during my life. The first goal, as has been explained, was when my mother was dying, and she told me that I was a bright child and I must get educated. And I remember as she told me that, it was such a shock, it was like an atom bomb had hit me. I was so stunned to think that I was a bright child. It was the last thing on earth I believed, because up to that time I felt I was more of a pest than anything else. Anyway, that was the first goal. Now I'm going to jump over to Smith College for the second goal, when a professor came to our department in psychology and gave a lecture on growing old, and what a joy it was to grow old and how to grow old. And that professor gave me a new goal then, the goal of growing old, a plan, how to grow old. And I never forgot it. And then after that, in Washington, D.C., I'm going to jump a bit, when I first got to Washington from our years in England, there was the editor of McCall's, who had been an editor for 25 years. She was 80 years of age. And at that point, I was beginning to say, my goodness, I'm 50 years old. I'm getting very old. And yet this 80-year-old editor gave the most brilliant, down-to-earth speech for women that I had ever heard. I didn't know that you could talk to people about these down-to-earth, everyday programs like that and be so full of common sense. And yet here she was, 80 years old. So never again did I even think or be alarmed that years were creeping on with me. I was going to be like that woman and be 80 years of old and be clever and down to earth and able to help women. So that was the third thing. And then the fourth tip I had happened before this in Baden-Baden, Germany, of all places. I went there completely filled with rheumatism. In England, people call arthritis rheumatism, and it comes on Americans especially from the perfectly awful British climate, and I could hardly walk when I got down. This English friend of mine tipped me off and told me to go down to Baden-Baden, where there was a great doctor named Dr. Eddie Schacht, the brother of the great Schacht that financed Hitler's program through Germany. And there also were sulfur baths. And this Dr. Eddie Schacht got a masseur, a Swedish masseur, who came to my room every morning and practically killed me, lifting every muscle clear off the bone as he helped me get rid of this rheumatism. And then I told Dr. Schacht, as I've explained here already, about my problem. I am a career woman, a public woman, and although I don't feel I'm superior to being glued to the kitchen stove, I didn't want to spend my life doing that. And he laid out a plan for my life, as I have explained in this book, how to run a home with children and how to get the right help that he explained the British women would teach me how to do this, how to keep that help. But he said I was to have one day off in seven. This was news to me. I thought once you got a baby, you were like a cow or a horse. You never left that little animal for 1 hour of the day or night. And I said to him, how can I have one day off in seven? Frankly, I didn't think anybody in America, I'd never been told that, could leave a baby for one day off in seven. And he explained even the Bible advocated that. And I said, how can I do it? And he said, that's why you've been educated, to teach you that. So there is the fourth bit of goals given me for my life that helped to make my life a success. I want to say a few more words about this theory of getting household help that I think I haven't covered yet. In America, the American woman, as I see her, and mother, is very possessive and very domineering, and she wants to do everything herself. I don't think I've said that before about the American woman homemaker. It has been ground into us. This is the way we must be a successful wife and mother. Never do anything else. But, of course, in the process, we neglect our husbands. We leave them. That's when our husband begins to go out with his secretary because he's lost his companion and his wife because she's so busy dominating the whole household and dominating the children. Well, it took me 6 years to learn this lesson. It's a very deep inheritance we have, and I want to just tell two more stories to illustrate how I learned the lesson. I ran an ad in the London paper for a governess. Everybody convinced me, with the dreadful climate and the fact that children had to be walked out for hours every day to get what fresh air there was, it was obvious you had to have more help. And American families were very popular with governesses. They were supposed to pay more money. And sure enough, I got 25 answers to my letter. Have I told this before? Well, anyway, how was I going to pick this governess? I still was very possessive about my children. Only I could take care of them, although I was utterly untrained to take care of little children, and I didn't think I could do it. I got 25 letters, and that very week, the American Woman's Club had a brilliant man from Czechoslovakia who was a reader of handwriting. And I immediately, that very week that I got the 25 letters, I called him up and asked him how much it would cost for him to analyze these letters. And he said it would cost $25. So I beat it down to his office, and he went through the letters, and he picked out one particular letter, he said, written by a woman who was absolutely talented and gifted for the care of little children. She was an older woman than I, he thought. But she's evidently had a great deal of experience, and she's a rare person. I immediately got in touch with her. She used the name of Cherry, C-H-E-R-I-E, and even now I've forgotten her real name. She was 60 years old. She had white hair. She had brought up three sets of children. and I immediately employed her. The very first day, she dropped the little boy on the floor when she went to put him in his crib. Incidentally, she really came to take care of my daughter, who had become a problem child, but she said I had to give her the little boy too, for I was taking care of him very successfully, but she couldn't be shut off with the little girl and have the little boy with me. And then she dropped him on the floor. It didn't hurt him any. He just slid down, and she also lost the key to the front door. So I immediately went back to the graphologist, they're called, and told him. Well, he said, what happened probably was that her family told her she was too old now to take care of any more children, and that she was nervous about it, and the boy wasn't hurt any. She was obviously nervous. So he said, you must mother that woman. Well, I said, that's a joke. I can't take care of my children, but I am to mother the woman who's to take care of the children. Yes, he said, she needs mothering. And if you will mother her and keep her comfortable and arrange her environment exactly as she wants it arranged, you will have a genius with your children. And he was right. I want to tell one story to illustrate how a woman like that can know every single thing that little children could do, which, of course, I didn't know. I had never taken care of little children. I didn't know anything about them. One night, this problem daughter, who was now a little over a year old or a year and a half old, woke up in the middle of the night and started to scream. And it was a wild scream that you could hear down the whole block. And her room was right next to the room of the governess. But my husband and I leapt out of bed, put on our dressing gowns, and came in and said, what's the matter, dearie, please? And the more we asked her, the louder she screamed. It was a bellow. You never heard such a scream. Suddenly, the door flung open, and the governess entered, and she really looked like Lady Macbeth. Her white hair was streaming. She had a very dramatic-looking long costume on. And what do you think she carried in her hand? A plate with two grapes on it. And she said to the screaming child, here, Rosemary, are some grapes. The screaming child said, what? Can I eat them now? And she said, if you'll stop that screaming, you can. Whereupon she grabs at the grapes, and my husband and I leave with our tails between the legs, humiliated. The next morning in the nursery, which was next to my bedroom, I heard this governess call this child every name she could think of. Why am I taking care of a child that would do such a thing as this? You knew I was right there, that I would come instantly if you needed something. And you screamed so the whole neighborhood could hear it. And she said, I don't know why I waste my time with such a child. And it went on all morning. And the child sat there with her eyes popping, horrified by the name she was called. But she never again woke up screaming. But the interesting thing was, too, that child wrapped me right around her finger. She was mostly Welsh. My husband is Welsh. And I'm half German. I'm rather thick-headed type of German. And that child at that age knew she could wrap me around her finger. They know those things more than you'd believe. And she knew it. And she still wraps me around her finger. I am no match for her intellectually at all. And I wasn't then, but this governess was. And the day the governess left, when we were coming back to America, having found a Swiss governess to be with us to get back to America, I escorted her down to the bus. And when I came back, the child was dancing on her bed. Her life had been saved because she was having convulsions. She was in great trouble with her health She was undoubtedly saved by this woman. She was dancing on her bed and saying, "She's gone, she's gone," filled with glee, because now the person that she couldn't wrap around her finger had left. The second story was the little boy, 9 months old. And one day she was downstairs getting the evening tray that had to be brought upstairs for their supper. And there was a little cupboard in the corner of the room where all the jams and jellies were kept. So the little boy, Richard, his name is, went over to that cupboard and got out the top jar of jam and plunged his hand down in the middle and grabbed up a wad of jam and pushed it in his mouth, and all of it strewed down on the floor and in front of him. And he managed to get away with most of the jar of jam when the nurse arrived. And she looked at him and she said, "Why, Richard," she said in this soft voice, "look what you have done." And she went and got a pail of water and a big cloth, and muttering about the mess and the fact that now none of them could have any jam for supper, whereupon his sister gave him a dirty look, and he couldn't eat any supper till she cleaned up this mess. And she talked a good deal about the mess and how awful it was to rob them of jam like this. This boy was 9 months old, couldn't speak, but he knew what she was saying. Children are a lot brighter than you know. That night, every night, I would have her come to the dining room and give me every incident that happened to those children during the day, and then explain to me what she had done to meet that. And then she asked me, "What would I have done with that boy?" And I just said, "I'd have spanked him." And she said, "That's the very worst thing you could have ever done." We don't settle questions like that with spanking ever. And she said, "I'm going to tell you another thing. That boy is natural and easy. He's going to be a very vocal child. But," she said, "you Americans, whenever you have children around, you discuss them with your grown-ups as if they weren't there. You ignore them, and so you've got a whole nation of children that can't even talk. They're self-conscious." And she said, "If you do that to that boy, when you get back to America, my ghost will rise up and smite you." Well, sure enough, when I got back to Needham one day, I was wheeling the boy down to the stores, and he had this down in his little go-cart, and he had these lovely pink cheeks and golden hair curls and blue eyes. And a club woman comes by and says, "Oh, is this your little boy?" And I warmed up, ready to discuss him. "He's down here in the chair. He isn't in the picture. You wouldn't do that with a grown-up," she explained. "You don't discuss them in their evidence." And I warmed up, getting ready to talk about my little boy, and I looked at the side, and there was her ghost standing, ready to smite me. So in a cold tone, I said to the woman, who didn't want to talk about my little boy, she just thought I did, "Yes, that's my son, Richard. Do you think it's going to rain today?" And, of course, she was delighted to get off the subject. I tell these stories to illustrate the technique and the delicacy with which the British people handle their children. And the result is, when those children grow up and have family life or go into public life, they are poised and deep and understanding, because they've always been that way. From the nursery, the training begins to teach them how to express themselves. So the whole British nation is vocal. And I used to follow Bernard Shaw around. I don't know whether I've told the story of going to the Fabian Summer School 2 summers and sitting at the table with Bernard Shaw. I think I've told that story. Do you know I followed Bernard Shaw all over London every time he spoke? And to hear Bernard Shaw speak was like hearing a great symphony. And do you know what he did with his great inheritance and income? He's dedicated the big schools in Scotland for the purpose of teaching speech all the way through. he was hipped on this subject of being vocal and knowing how to express yourself. And do you know another thing? Yesterday, 2 days ago, I heard Joan Calkins present some pictures and the story of child care centers in Russia. She spent the whole summer. And do you know what the Russians do? They begin with little 6 months old children talking to them as if they're grown-ups. And make it the one thing they emphasize in those child care centers, not the Russian government as we've been taught, but how to express themselves. They're taught words, meanings of words, how to say what they think. And do you know what happens when those Russians go out to represent their government all over the world, strange nations in Africa or anywhere? They are made to learn that nation's language before they go. And our Americans come over to Europe and to England, and the only language they know is the American language, and they don't know that. They don't even know how to make good public speakers. We needn't worry about Russia's possibility of bombing us. Russia is licking us now through the power of the spoken word. And they go down to these strange countries and speak their language and crow about their government and tell them what they're going to do from their government. And what do we do when we go down to those? We can't speak to those people. We get into a big house and swirl around in big cars and act important, and we can't communicate with those people at all. We should get worried about Russia from the point of view of the spoken word, which we in this country are neglecting completely. It is an educational, cultural lag that's a tragedy. And this I learned in England, and this I just learned from Joan Calkins in her picture. And she didn't make any example of it, but she said she couldn't understand why in the child care centers they were giving all this attention to the vocalization of words and feelings. Hmm. And that's why, and I have a statement here now in the Progress Bulletin that puts that in another word. Can you turn this off a minute while I get this thing? On this very subject, I want to quote a statement that was made by the President the other day in the Progress Bulletin, Friday, March 22nd. And this is what he said. I could push this button right here, and in 20 minutes, 70 million Russians would be dead, he told a secret strategy session on March 8th. And 25 minutes later, 70 million Americans would be dead, he added. He also spoke admiringly of the cold courage that the late President Kennedy demonstrated during the nuclear showdown with Russia in 72. But on March 8th, according to the confidential minutes, he spoke only of averting the massive casualties he would cause by pushing the nuclear button. We should pray a lot, he told party leaders, and do everything in our power to get along with the Soviets. The way to prevent a long-term crisis, he said, was to avert a short-term crisis. One way this could be accomplished, he urged, was to grant them trade concessions. If we don't talk to them, if we don't trade with them, we're going to face enormous increases in defense expenditures. The president argued that it is possible to deal with the Soviets without approving of their ideology. Now there it is in the nucleus, to work, to trade with them and to speak with them and give them some of our nice consumer goods that all the women would like. And yet a lot of people are complaining because we gave them all that wheat. I think that's just great to keep in touch with them as he's doing with our trades that we have. Nothing will quiet them down like that, and that means speech. Well, there's enough on that about the British nursery system, but I have not mentioned what my husband did. in the 8 years in England. You know, I felt rather superior when I married my husband. He had never set foot in a college. I'm a Smith graduate. And I thought I had perhaps lowered myself a little to marry this man. Well, what do you think? He was employed as a trade commissioner by the United States Department of Commerce and at the American Embassy in London. And all of a sudden, out of the blue, he decides to write a book on England. And he had, by this time, he was assistant commercial attaché in charge of that office with 13 men under him, all college men and a lot with high college degrees. And in the end, he wrote a 940-page book on the United Kingdom, an industrial, commercial, and financial handbook, which the British government sent to all their agencies all over the world, which had never been written before. I think by that time I began to feel a little more humble about my non-educated husband. And now that he's older and ill and in his 80s as I am, I look back on my married life together and I feel proud that I had the opportunity to make a good life for this federally employed man in our government, typical of thousands of men who keep our government going, are still there in Washington, and they really sacrifice their lives. My husband is one of the few men still alive among the men he worked with. They die from overwork and strain. And I'm very proud that I was taught by Dr. Eddie Schock how to run my home so that my husband, who came out at night from tense experiences, unbelievable heavy experiences, I was able to keep my home running so sweetly on greased wheels with no strain. And I think, frankly, this is one of the greatest things I've done in my life, is to have helped that brilliant man carry on with the work that he did there in Washington and in London with no college education back of him, and accomplished miracles. And if I haven't done anything else with my life but have made his life smooth and even so he could do that, I feel proud to have had that opportunity. I have one more thing that I don't think I've told, and that's about the school system and what happened in Needham, the suburb of Boston. You see, when we came back from England after 8.5 years, we had become so accustomed to England. It takes four years to get used to England and then 4 years to be happy. And so it took 4 years to get used to America again and the things that were so different. And I had never voted. While we were in England, the women were given the vote. And so when we got into this suburb of Boston, just outside of Boston, and as I said, took this beautiful three-story house, and we had enough antique furniture to fill 11 rooms, and I was able to rent the top floor to school teachers so that they paid enough rent to carry the house on. And then suddenly I was able to teach speech and to lecture all over New England, and found a marvelous governess for my children. That in itself was a miracle. I think I've told that story. Well, as I was walking down toward the center of this little Needham, one of the club women met me again, and she said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I thought we'd go down and introduce ourselves to the superintendent of schools." And she said, "Oh, that's a joke. He's a crook." And I said, "What? Now, I'm just back from England to my darling America and voting in a sweet New England town. And I'm told that the school superintendent is a crook." And I said, "Well, why don't you get rid of him?" And she said, we can't get rid of him because every time we try, he wrecks our personal lives and our reputations. And I said, well, what does he do that is such a crook? Well, he just loves to build new school buildings. We don't know why he likes it so well. And then even in the first grade, when now most first grades are in classes where they can move the desks, he goes down to the school authorities and buys the old screw-down desks that are clear out of order and out of style because they're cheaper. Well, I said, why don't your parent-teacher association get after him? She said, don't make me laugh. He won't let us have a parent-teacher association. We haven't got a parent-teacher association. We have a little association that he organizes and runs and puts all the people in office that he wants in office. Well, I carried on to the office of this gentleman, and one look verified what I'd been told. I never saw such a slimy, crooked-looking face on any man in my life. But I was very polite and said I had come to meet him as we moved to town. Our children were going to be here. And I would like to talk to him. And I said, there's just a one thing that bothered me were these desks in the first grade that our little boy were all screwed down to the floor. And he said, well, you'll probably find a lot of other things you don't like here, so you can just let us know what they are. Well, then I rented, as I said, the top floor to school teachers, and another woman told me that he wouldn't let those school teachers stay in anybody's house unless that family were his known supporters. And I said, what? You mean that he decides where the school teachers are to live or not live? Oh, yes. No school teachers can stay in a house unless the house is the owners of the house are known to be his supporters. Well, I said, for heaven's sake, why don't you do something about such a dictatorship? And they said, we can't do anything. He always ruins our reputation. He gets the best of us, and we just don't dare do anything. Well, of course, I just licked my chops, naturally. And I'm not going into great detail on what I did, but I did find that there was a woman in town, quite well-placed financially, who felt the same way about it, but alone she didn't feel she could fight this battle. And when she heard that I was aroused about it and thought it had to be ended at once, she then declared herself as a candidate to go on the school board and got elected. And in no time at all, the gentleman was out of a job. But I was out of something. I got a mastoid in my left ear. It had been very cold, I suppose. I hadn't taken good care of myself. And I ended up in the hospital with a terrible operation and the whole side of my head cut open and lost my hearing. And that, of course, I know now psychologically had to do with this rumpus. I know it was a pure psychological situation that developed of my getting it mixed up into such a crooked situation. But when we left, moved away from this town soon after that, when the depression came and my husband had to leave his job, one of the leading women in town called on me and said, Jesse, we are very grateful to you. You have saved our school system in this town. But I learned a hard lesson that I should not get mixed up with local political situations like that would react on my family and my personal life. And I should have been more careful and restrained as a result. But the nicest thing that happened to me in that town was Leslie Cutler. I heard that she was trying to get in the state legislature. And at that time, there were no women in any state legislatures anywhere or in the Congress. And she had run twice and been defeated. So I got in my little car and drove out to her home one day. I had gone to hear her lecture. And she was rich. She was beautiful. She had gone to MIT and had the first course at MIT on public health that had ever been given to a woman. She was thoroughly trained. But to make a speech, she wrote it out and memorized it. And then with a wild look on her face, she looked up at first one quarter of the room and then the other, trying to remember what were the words on the top of the second page. And her speaking was horrible. So I got in my car and drove out there, and she was then preparing another speech. And her living room was filled with all these papers all over the room with a written speech. And I told her that I had just been invited to come to the Woman City Club on Beacon Street and put on a course in public speaking for women. I had just had a very meager course in London, as you know. I was not trained officially for teaching, but I was just going to try. I thought I could do as well as the lady in London did. And she said, "But Jessie, I'm not interested in elocution." And I said, "Well, my dear, I don't teach elocution, but please, I beg you to just come to one lesson." And she did. And she said, "I never heard anything like it." She took two courses, one right after the other. The course became very popular very rapidly. And the next time she ran, she was elected overwhelmingly. She had everything to be elected for except the speech. She stayed in the lower house for 10 years, and I had the great joy of visiting her when she was in the state senate, the only woman in the state senate for 20 years. And she completely revolutionized the whole mental health program of the state of Massachusetts, which was in shocking condition. And you'll be glad to hear that she came back to California to get some of her ideas from what California was doing, for instance, with women in the nice women's prison we have, separate from men there in Massachusetts. The women were in the same buildings with the men, and their situation was terrible. She also got the first bill through to allow women to serve on juries. At that point, there were no women on juries. And then she found that in Massachusetts there was a terrible orphanage filled with the little children who'd gone blind because the parents had venereal disease. All the states around Massachusetts did not allow people to be married unless they were tested first with venereal disease, but Massachusetts wanted them to come there and they weren't tested. So everybody that wanted to be married all around Massachusetts came to Massachusetts to get married without testing. And I asked her how she made that Senate pass that law to require everybody in Massachusetts to be tested for venereal disease. And she said, "I'll tell you how I got that law passed. I went out to that terrible hospital where all those little blind children were, that got blind because their parents had venereal disease. And at that time, nobody spoke in public on the subject of venereal disease. It was not a nice subject to talk about. And I stood up in that Senate and I described what I had seen in that hospital in clear terms. And everybody was shocked and horrified. And the bill went through. Enormously." Tell you about Leslie Cutler. I wrote her 2 years ago that I was trying to get my book into a paperback. Every time I saw Leslie Cutler, and I did stop there quite a number of times, she said, "You know, Jesse, I would not be here except for you." She said, "Well," I said, "what did I teach you?" And she said, "You taught me how to think and talk on my feet. And without knowing that, you cannot be a success in public life. You must know how to think and talk on your feet." She said, 2 months ago, the Republican Party met to select the candidate for the the vice chairman of the governor. What do you call the one that's next?
Of the party?
Oh, of the party. What do you call the one who's next to the governor?
The lieutenant governor.
Lieutenant to governor. And she said, I asked them to make me a candidate for the lieutenant governor. And at that meeting, she said, they appointed a man to be lieutenant governor who was utterly unqualified, as a character unfit to be lieutenant governor. And yet they appointed him and turned me down. And she said, because she was a woman, she said, do you know what I did? I walked up in front of that audience and I said, gentlemen, you have made a decision today that you will live to regret. And the day will come when a woman will walk up to this audience and be elected by the Republican Party for the job of lieutenant governor. And you will live to see that day. And I said to her, at what moment did you think of saying that? And she said, as I walked up to the platform, I thought of it. Well, then I told her I wanted to get my book into a paperback, and it was going to cost a lot of money, and I didn't have it, and she sent me a check for $1,000. And you know what I did? I was so proud, and I left it in my desk 2 or 3 days. I just wanted to feel it was there. And 3 days after that, she had all her family that Sunday for dinner. She had six children, and she'd had six children. All the grandchildren were there. Everybody was there. And after the dinner, she went upstairs to rest and died.
How old was she?
80. She was 80 years old. She was. She became the senator of the state of Massachusetts for 20 years as a result of the. And she was the one woman of the hundreds of women that I've taught who took the trouble to keep on thanking me. I've almost had no thanks from anybody else, although I've known the wonderful things they've done with their training, but they never bothered to write me or thank me for that training. But she did. Always, she said, Jesse, I could have never done it if it hadn't been for you. So there you see is the story of a great woman.
Jesse, had she been involved in the suffrage struggle before she...
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Not too much, I don't think, because she was very much involved with her six children. Mm-hmm. And I don't think she had worked actively, but she was mentally a feminist. Mm-hmm. There was no doubt about that because of the way... Now, I have another story about the Shenandoah Mountains. We're now leaving Needham, and we're back in Washington to the hideout that my husband and I had up in the Shenandoah Mountains. And this is why he's still alive in the 80s, and why I'm still alive. We went up to those Shenandoah Mountains every weekend and for the whole summer and rested. And he would take his billfold that all the men go out of offices in Washington to work over Saturday and Sunday. And he would have his billfold there that he was going to work. And the minute we turned into the roadway that led to our little hideout, and he heard the first cow moo and the first chicken crackle, this crow, he'd get limp. And by the time we got up there and got unpacked and got some good food, and all our darling hillbilly neighbors loaded us with beautiful vegetables from their gardens, he'd go so limp and he'd never get that billfold open. And that was just what he'd need. But at the end of Sunday, he would just sit out for 2 days looking at the mountains. Didn't seem as if he was thinking or just he was just sitting there. But on the way home, he'd say, I know the answer to this problem. And he had solved in 1 minute for some problem that nobody else could solve. And if in the United States government they had the wisdom to take a man like that and put him in a room by himself and give him the problems and say, what are we to do about this? He'd have the answers. But what they want him all to be doing is working at pills, writing letters, doing mechanical things, or they're not good employees. They haven't learned the value of creative thinking, which of course